I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, fluttering and dancing in the breeze. Continuous as the stars that shine and twinkle on the Milky Way, they stretched in never-ending line along the margin of a bay. 10,000 saw I at a glance, tossing their heads in sprightly dance. The waves beside them danced, but they outdid the sparkling waves in glee. A poet could not but be gay in such a jocund company. I gazed and gazed, but little thought what wealth the show to me had brought. For oft, when on my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye which is the bliss of solitude, and then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Greetings, fellow Odysseans of the aberrant seas of the writerly mind, engineers of Lego metropolises, and everyone else, to episode 11 of The Drunken Odyssey, con moi. Aha, I've made it this far. So in terms of academic life, the summer's nearly over. Next week, the fall term and its multifarious responsibilities begin, which means that the summery vista of writing time is nearly gone. This weekend, I'm going to try and write both a short story, nearly from scratch, and a book review whose extended deadline is now staring me angrily in the face. There's still a revision of an academic essay, as well as two journalistic pieces that I had hoped to finish and get in the publication pipeline before the fall. Of course, I've been living this life a while now, so before I judge myself or panic or go, aw, shit, instead I start the mental negotiations. I rationalize that the burdens of my teaching really only begin in earnest once I get student essays to grade. I'm teaching mostly material I've taught before, which means that my prep time for classes is actually a tidy proposition. On the days I don't teach, I can make some progress on my writing projects, get some more of them out there. The fall really doesn't start until the middle of September. Really. Mostly. 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 There is a big change with the new semester that I can't ignore, however. My friend and colleague and interlocutor, I always think of Henry James when I say this word, which is why I seldom say interlocutor. What was I saying? Yaroslav has moved north to the most writerly borough of Brooklyn to begin his MFA work at NYU. He found himself shanghaied on an express train yesterday. Just because a metro line goes through a station on the map doesn't, alas, mean that it will stop at that station. This happened to me in my first month in New York, on one errant trip on the A train. There was a beautiful queasy helplessness in watching the blur of stations go by. He knows better now, but Yaroslav, let me also warn you of trains that actually change identity while you're riding on them. Their narrative goes something like this.
Attention passengers, starting at Blavsnew Avenue and Blue Brazoon Avenue, this train will become a MLA train, express to Winnipeg.
Anyway, Yaroslav, I'm incredibly proud of you. enjoy the ride. On today's show, I interview the amazing Mitchell S. Jackson. Robert Kingette discusses William Wordsworth, and once again, I valiantly answer your mail. So I got to know Mitchell a little bit when we worked together at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He was a teacher there, and for reasons I never quite understood, I was his teaching assistant. I was made the teaching assistant for several people, despite the fact that I had a PhD. And usually the people who I was assisting did not have PhDs. So I wasn't bitter about this, but I did find it puzzling. One reason why I didn't feel any bitterness about this at all in Mitchell's case was because he was so entertaining to watch as a teacher. His students are incredibly, incredibly fortunate. And it turns out, and I didn't know this at the time, but Mitchell is also, I mean, I had a reason to think this, but now I know this, he's an extraordinary writer. So let's get into the interview and hear what he has to say.
And now, the interview of the day.
Mitchell Jackson is author of the e-book Oversoul, Stories and Essays, and is also the author of the novel The Residue Years, forthcoming from Bloomsbury Press next year. Mitchell, welcome to The Drunken Odyssey.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the publication of Oversoul. I really didn't know what to expect from your writing since, you know, we knew each other. I was your teaching assistant at John Jay College. And I just remember watching your teaching with awe a little bit because you're doing things I wouldn't have thought of doing.
Okay.
I have to admit, I was a little bit curious about your choice to have a collection that was fiction and essays. And normally when I see something like that, it's just sort of a casual salad of, you know, well, here's a bunch of stuff I wrote. But after I read the manuscript, I was really impressed at the symmetry, how carefully composed that this book is. So I was wondering if you could talk about the decision to both include fiction and essay, since it seemed a fairly systematic decision in Oversoul.
I guess it was partially because that was what I had available to me at the time. So I came up with this decision to do Oversoul about maybe 7 months ago. And I had some short stories and I had sent out two of them. And one of them had got actually hand downs, palm up. I had sent to the New Yorker cold. And this guy at the New Yorker named Stanley Ledbetter, he actually received it, emailed me back, said he was going to read it. Then he read it and he said he loved it. And so he was like, I'm going to show everyone in the office this work. He emailed me back and was like, basically, they said that they would pass on it, but that they were intrigued. And so that I should send them more work. So I felt like I had something with hand down, palm up, that if I could kind of create something that was around that, or, you know, in that same, I don't want to say genre, but in that same vein, that, you know, it was worth something. But I was tired of sending out the story. So I said, man, I'm just going to kind of see if I can put these together. And so I had some essays also that I felt the same way about, that I had wrote for publication and then kind of put away and didn't. I really wasn't pursuing, you know, as a writer, you know how tough it is to keep sending stuff out. And I guess in that sense, I'm kind of lazy. So I had this work and I was like, okay, well, thematically, I think it kind of all fits together. So why don't I kind of go back in, edit these things, and then see if I can, you know, find a way to arrange them so that they make sense. So it was stuff that I had together, but it worked out because I, you know, my fascinations are always the same when I'm, or usually the same when I'm writing, that the stuff kind of worked together.
Well, I noticed that not only that, but the themes line up from the fiction section and the essay section.
Mm-hmm.
That head down, palm up is very much about growing up in a rough urban environment and just showing how that shapes, you know, the personalities of the people who live there. And the first essay is, this is what it means to say Portland, which seemed to cover a lot of the same ground,
or
the same themes.
Mm-hmm.
Oversoul is about this mentor figure who turns out not to be ideal.
Right, yeah.
And then the second essay is Portrait of a Lifeguard about John Edgar Wideman, who a bit more ideal.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more distant, but certainly far more ideal. You know, the third story, Presidents, is told from the point of view of a woman dealing with the difficulty of being in these urban environments. And Matrimony and Epic is about your mother,
mm-hmm.
sort of upping the stakes and saying, well, you know, here's one woman that I'm going to tell you about mm-hmm. who's real. And then After Everything is about, you know, the romantic, I'm not sure how to put it, catastrophes.
Yeah. Catastrophe is the right word. Yeah.
Catastrophes. And then you really, in the essay section, you put that, you really drive that home with your essay, Serial Killers, There Are No Alibis,
mm-hmm.
where you are fairly ruthless mm-hmm. in analyzing the mentality of players.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really impressed just how the symmetry of the book. I didn't quite expect that.
Yeah. You know, I had 7 in the beginning, and I was like, no, 7's not going to work. It has to be 8. And so Serial Killer was actually the only thing that I wrote that was brand spanking new. I wrote that, you know, in about 2 or 3 weeks or something, or maybe, 2 weeks or a week. In my mind, I was just like, let me see if I can write the most honest thing that I've ever wrote about women. Because I had wrote After Everything, and I sent it to a friend. And my friend said, yeah, this is really good, something, you know, your relational crimes. And that just that relational crimes, it stuck out to me. And I started thinking, damn, it really is a crime. It's a crime. And then from that, I started thinking about the idea of serial killer, and kind of I ran it by another. I don't know if you know Marco Navarro. He used to teach at John Jay. Well, he actually went to NYU when I was there. And he was like, man, you have to couch. You can't just talk about your experience. You have to couch it in something that other people will recognize. And then that's when I came up with the idea to use the analogy of serial killers. So that was it worked out that, you know, I was thinking symmetry in terms of having 4 and 4, but it also worked out when I started thinking, well, how am I going to arrange these things, that they kind of echoed each other.
Well, and I think it comes off really powerfully. And, you know, there are just so many great resonances between the stories and between the essays that I couldn't have anticipated. So while I was skeptical, I have to admit, when I saw the label on the title page there,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you totally won me over.
Oh, that's good.
And I was really impressed by the sort of bombastic style that you write in,
mm-hmm.
And the way that in this bombastic style, there's a rage against inarticulation,
mm-hmm.
and there's this constant conversation that your narrators have with the reader that I just find really interesting. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you saw yourself coming to this approach to writing.
Well, you know, I came to writing really, really late. Like, I don't remember reading books as a child. I'm sure I read something, but I couldn't recall reading a book. I couldn't recall reading a book in high school. You know, there was no reading list for me. And so I didn't even start reading literary fiction until I was already in graduate school. And the first thing that I read that I can remember was Go Tell It on the Mountain, James Baldwin. And I just remember thinking, like, ah, this guy sounds like a writer. Like, this is how you're supposed to do it. And so I spent, you know, a good year or two just trying to sound like James Baldwin. And then the first year in graduate school at NYU. So I went to 2 programs, PSU, and then I went right to NYU. And my first year at NYU, I had Paul Marshall. And Paul Marshall, one of the first stories she gave us was this story called Wait by John Edgar Wideman. And I read Wait, and Wait sounded to me like the people that I'd grown up with, but it was literary fiction. And then I started reading up on John Edgar Wideman. I was like, oh, they respect this guy. And I was like, wow, okay. So maybe I can start to write.
You could do it that way.
Yeah, maybe I can do it like a way that feels more authentic to me, and it'll work out. And so I kind of started coming to that voice in my work. But then I had a workshop with Gordon Lish. And one of the things that he preaches in his, it's not a workshop, but his classes, is that you have to find your difference. Like, you need to find what it is that makes you special. And so I think one of the things that makes me special is that I grew up around, though I didn't have books around me and I didn't grow up a reader, I grew up around these people who were really good storytellers, and they had these really unique voices that I kind of took for granted while I was growing up. But now that I'm an adult, I'm like, I don't hear these people anymore. And so a lot of my work is like an ode to those people. But I also have it in my head that, you know, I have this other life that I've developed from the age of, let's say, 23 on, and that I have to try to include that voice, too. So I'm always kind of, there's always this kind of competition between the two selves in my work. I think that's probably the best way to say it.
And how would you describe those two selves?
Well, there's the one guy who, you know, kind of grew up listening to his pimp uncles and his drug dealer friends and listening to rap music. And then there's this other guy that loves Barry Hanna and Raymond Carver and, you know, James Baldwin is his hero. I guess it's like a little urban or street and then an aspiring intellectual. Like, I wouldn't ever call myself an intellectual, but I like smart people. They really impress me.
And you went straight to ebooks with Oversoul. I'm wondering what was behind that decision, because that's a decision a lot of writers right today are eyeballing, and they're not sure they should do it. And of course, writers are very superstitious and tend to be old fashioned. Once we hit 30, we think we're done learning new technology.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what your process was and how you came to that decision.
Well, it was a few things. One, I guess the real impetus was when I was on our listserv and I read about this woman, Darcy Chan, that's her name. Now it came back to me. Darcy Chan had wrote a book. I wouldn't consider it literary fiction. And then I just saw, you know, the kind of reception she received. And so that intrigued me. And then I had been reading, you know, I get the, what is it, Media Bistro and the Publishers Weekly. And I keep getting these things about how ebooks are taking over, how just this last quarter they sold more ebooks than they sold hardcovers. And also, I had signed my book contract with Bloomsbury for my novel. And this was, I think I signed it in February. And they were telling me, okay, you're going to be spring of next year. So it was more than a year away. And I was like, damn, that's how long it takes to get a book. I mean, I understand you have to edit it, but it just seemed like such a long time. And I said, well, I'd like to have something in the world before then. You know, if people get a chance to experience me maybe before the novel comes out, then maybe that'll be better. I can win over a few people. So the ebook gave me the chance to do that more quickly than going the traditional hardcover and waiting, you know, 7 years to see daylight. And then I think also I used to think I was a hustler, but I guess I really wasn't a hustler. I was just maybe a follower. But it feels exciting to me because it's this new technology and we don't know where it's going. And I feel like I'm one of the, you know, you get in early and you take your lumps, but you're also experiencing something that other people won't get to experience in this way.
And how's the response been to the ebook in terms of finding readers? And has there been a lashback or?
No, I was scared of the lashback because I talked to one of my writer friends more established than me. And she was telling me about this girl from, I can't remember her name, but she had an ebook that she published after she was under contract with Riverhead. And they made her she refused to take it down. Riverhead wanted her to take the book down and she refused. And they said they were going to, and they did. They took her advance back and killed the publication of her novel. So I was scared that my publisher wouldn't support me. But it turns out that they were really supportive, that they've people in the company have read it and they like it. As far as readers, you know, the funny thing is, and this is something I feel a little unique in, this is that I feel like I'm always writing for people. Like when I imagine my reader, I imagine the people back home, like some of the characters in my novels, I imagine them reading them and appreciating, going, wow, like I'm in a story. My voice is in a story. This person that's like me is in a story. But the reality of that is those people don't read. So then I'm writing stories about people and for people who don't read. So I have to go find readers to read these things that they might not recognize much of themselves in. So despite that, though, I feel like the people that come to Oversoul I think they see quality in the work, you know, and I'm really hopeful. Like I have, you know, some reviews lined up and I'd be anxious to see what they say, because I feel confident. Like it's not like, I don't know how other writers feel when it's time to get reviewed by other people. I guess there's a little anxiousness or trepidation, but I'm like, let's go. What you got to say? I really want to see it.
Well, I can't speak for other writers. I know from my own point of view, not that I've had the opportunity, but yeah, I would look at it with complete trepidation, but my main thing is, please God, somebody say something.
Yeah.
I don't care if you hate me. Just don't ignore me.
Yeah, exactly.
But it must be pretty thrilling to have at least the control over Oversoul that you have.
Yeah.
And that you could say, you know what, in a couple months, I'm going to get a book out there.
Yeah.
And you did.
Yeah. Yeah. I wish it was that easy. It was a lot of – I learned a lot during this experience. It was you know, it's enriching, though. I took my advance, or a good portion of my advance, and did it. So I banked on myself, and, you know, I remember we used to shoot dice in high school, and they used to say, scared man can't win. Bet it all or don't bet at all.
And is that actually a good strategy?
Well, I think there's a good bit of, you know, I think to be a good writer, you have to have a confidence in your skill. And, you know, I think once you, I don't think that it could fail because I finished it. Like I said, I was going to do it and I did it and it's out in the world. So to me, there's the accomplishment. Like what other people say about it, it'll be great. If it sells, you know, 500,000 copies, awesome. But to me is, you know, I did it. And I also did it, you know, I spoke to the people that I wanted to speak to too. Like I don't feel like it's inauthentic. You know, I'm happy about it.
Well, writing a book, there's just so many stages. Yeah, I think that, you know, I occasionally I would tell people, oh, I'm writing a novel, and people would be impressed. And I'm like, don't be impressed that I'm writing a novel. Anybody can write a novel. All right, everyone write down the word he. Okay, everyone, you're writing a novel. That's not special. Finishing a novel, that's special. Publishing a novel, it's finishing a novel, finding representation, getting it published. Like those so I was actually pretty pleased when I finished my book.
Yeah.
But up until then, I'm like, I'm not accomplishing anything.
Right, yeah, I had that feeling, yeah. Or you can't see it. You are accomplishing something, but it's, you know, it's so incremental that you don't really recognize it some days.
Right, right. I mean, nothing will happen if you don't actually put in the work every day or every other day and actually, you know, crank out the words. But anybody can just crank out words, like actually having a book with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
That's an accomplishment.
Right, yeah.
And even then, yeah, so – and then I get to that accomplishment and I'm less impressed than I was before I had finished it. But so it goes. So it goes.
Yeah.
Not too many happy writers who are just like, oh, I love everything about my life.
Yeah,
like,
right? Yeah, where are they?
Well, they're a handful, but yeah, most of us, not so much. So I was wondering if you could take us through the path you took to become a writer. You said you found James Baldwin sort of at the beginning of this trajectory where you decided, oh, that's something special. That's something I want to be a part of.
Yeah.
And so walk us through that a little bit and your undergraduate experience.
So undergraduate, I wanted to be a basketball player. So I went to community college first because I didn't get the big time offers I wanted. And also I said, okay, I'll go tear up a community college. So I went to one. I was a nuthead. I actually failed my first English class, which I tell my students now. I don't want them to fail, but I tell them that. And so I got into it with the coach.
That's
played.
Awesome.
Yeah, right? That I failed my first English class. So I wanted to be a basketball player for my first 2 years of college. That, you know, and I did play. I played. I thought I played pretty well. I averaged 20-something points. But then my coach in the school that I went to, he was like, man, listen, you're kind of smart. Because he was actually my high school counselor also. He said, Mitch, you're smart. There's this scholarship that you should apply for. You know, it's not athletic, but you should apply for it. So it's a minority achievement scholarship. And so I won the scholarship. So I ended up going to a university on a kind of a minority academic scholarship. But I just picked Bachelor's of Speech Communications because it didn't involve math and I hated math. So I didn't have really a plan in undergrad at all. And then when I finished, when in between my junior year and my senior year of college, I got caught selling drugs. So I went to prison. When I came back, I finished up school. I had like a year left. And I said, okay, well, you know, I got a felony now, so my job options aren't looking too swell. But for some reason, no one ever ran background checks on me. So I said, okay, I'm going to be a newscaster. I went and got a job working at a news station writing scripts. And I liked writing scripts, but I hated. I was on a morning show, 4 or 5 a.m. or something like that. Yeah, it was. You come in at. I think I used to come in at 3 or 1 or something like that, and then work till 8. It was terrible, man. And then one day I was on the internet and I saw that my alma mater was just starting a graduate writing program.
What was that school again? Portland State University.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so they were starting their graduate program, and I was just like, ooh, I should just go get a master's. Not I should become a writer, not I like writing, not any of those. It was just I should get a master's. Like, it'll be cool to be in the hood and be, you know, and tell people I have a master's. So that's what I was thinking. So then I called the lady up. I said, hey, listen, I'd like to apply for this. I want to hear how you apply for this program. Can you tell me anything more? She's like, well, actually, sir, you missed the deadline. I said, oh, man. She said, but if you could get me the application and your writing sample by a week, I'll consider you. So now I have never written a piece of fiction in my life. I can only remember reading 2 novels, and those were the 2 I read in prison. And one of them was How Stella Got Her Groove Back. So I don't really have I don't have any touchstones. I don't have any, you know, I went, and that's when I went to the library and I got James Baldwin's Go Tell on the Mountain. And that's when I read it. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to write something like this. So I wrote it was supposed to be 25 pages of writing sample, and I must have wrote like 10 to 12 pages, and I called her back in a week. I said, well, listen, I got my recommendations, but I only have 12 pages. If you could give me another couple days, I'll get it to you. So I sent them to her, and she says, and then I called back like a week later. I said, okay, I got those other 12 pages. She's like, don't worry about it, you're in. And I was like, whoa, okay, I'm in? Wow. And then, so when I got in there, I had to start reading. I started learning a few things about writing. I wouldn't say it was like the greatest writing experience of my life, but I started thinking. I started listening to other people in workshop and reading books, and then I started thinking, maybe I can really do this. So I was already in graduate school before I even considered that I might be able to do this for a living or, you know, publish. Yeah, I kind of fell into it, I guess you would say, and then discovered that I liked it.
Well, I went through something similar in grad school. Towards the end of undergrad, I made my first great humanitarian act, and I stopped writing poetry. And then, you know, through what I was reading, I'm like, oh, here's the good stuff. Here's okay. And I sort of, you know, reset my whole way of thinking about it. So hopefully, you know, that's one of the services that grad school can serve.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think you got to NYU before me, right?
Yeah, I left in 04, so I was there 02 to 04. I didn't take any extra semesters like some people. I just went straight through. It was killing me. When
were you there? When I was there, I was there 07 to 010.
Okay.
Well, not 010, just 10. But yeah, I didn't see any upside to leaving.
Yeah, no, right? I was just worried about the money.
Well, that was the main reason why I finished up. And I dragged it out about as far as I could.
Mm-hmm.
And then moved to Florida, where it's a hell of a lot cheaper to live. But yeah, apart from the whole cost thing, you know, it's literary fantasy camp.
Yeah, you know, definitely.
That was my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So what was your experience like, and who did you work with, and what did you learn?
So I worked with Brayton Breitenbach. That was my first workshop leader. I worked with Paul Marshall. I worked with I got EL doctoral my last semester. Chuck Wattel. And who else did I have? I must have had someone else. I can't remember who else I have. It was inspirational to be around those people. And I think what I got most out of that is names that I should be reading. Now, I don't want to say what I got most out of it, but I started, you know, because most people in graduate writing programs are avid readers. And so I started listening to them talk about what they'd read and their experiences. It also, I think, to me, was a confidence builder, because I knew coming in that I've always felt like I'm in the rear of a professional writing experience. And so to kind of hear what other people were doing, and then to put my work out also to be critiqued, it gave me a sort of the confidence I needed to keep going. And then I wouldn't say that I really came out of there. Like, some people come out of there with a mentor. Like, I know Chuck, he's a mentor figure for a few people, but I was never one of those writers who kind of sought out communication really outside of the classroom. Like, I might go to your office hours, you know, once a semester for something. But so I didn't take advantage of it in that way. But I did come out of there with graduate with two or three readers. And I think that's, you know, maybe one of the greatest things that you can get out of a graduate program is leaving with two or three people you can for a lifetime share work with. So that was important to me. And then, you know, the confidence that being around all those writers and kind of seeing what everyone was doing. Yeah.
Well, the reason why I was laughing earlier is I don't know if Chuck is a mentor of mine, but I do feel like he's one of my literary godfathers.
Yeah, see, yeah. Right?
Like, I don't know that his writing and my writing is completely compatible, but on the other hand, you know, yeah, it's kind of a close relationship.
Yeah.
In some ways. It's
and he has that with a few people, I'm sure.
Well, partly, you know, he's the only professor there in the creative writing program at NYU who focuses on novel writing.
Oh.
And since that's where, you know, that's where the market is mostly, you know, the publishers are hungry for novels. And so he gets all the novelists. And, I think we're needier than people who are devoted to writing short stories.
Yeah, we got more issues. We got long-term issues.
yeah. So I was hoping you could read a little bit.
Oh, okay. So head down, palm up. I want to preface this by saying that this story, I think this is an interesting backstory. This story, one day, so my uncle was like an ex-everything in Portland. I mean, you name the crime, he did it. And so, and as a result, he spent, you know, half of his, you know, probably three-fourths of his life in and out of prison. So my brother called me one day or texted me or something and said, man, you seen Uncle Henry on YouTube? And I was like, nah. He's like, man, you got to watch this YouTube video. So he sends me the link and I go on to watch it. And it's my uncle. He has a How to Pimp video on YouTube.
This thing. Oh, my God.
Yeah, you could go. I could send you the link after this. But, yeah, so. So it's literally like he's telling them, like, you know, don't do this and do that and put your hands on him if you want. So I watched this. And I was always fascinated with this uncle because he's a guy who also, like, went to college. I think he studied engineering, used to own a bunch of businesses. Like, he's a smart man, but he's, you know, I don't want to say diminished, but he's at a point in his life where he's making How to Pimp YouTube videos. And so I started to think about him because he was also a mentor figure for me when I used to hustle. So I started kind of imagining what that mentorship would be like in another area. So that's how I came up with the idea for Head Down, Palm Up. And also that my pimp dad, he's really my stepfather. He used to always say, Mitchell, when it comes to women, keep your head down and palm up, son. You hear me? Keep your head down and palm up. And that stuck with me for life. Okay, so I have this in front of me, head down, palm up. So I'll read maybe like a page or so. It's hard to see Unc in the shade, with his being the same shade as the shade. But you can always depend to watch his mouth, to track that gold tooth, a glinting last-to-last extravagance. It's position, not possession. Unc says, not possession, but position, he says, and swanks into view. He throws contemplative eyes to the sky. They're the familiar bug eyes, impressive eyes, so big he might see the future or maybe even another dimension. The man motions me closer, flaunting the only ring he wears, probably his only ring left to wear, a pinky joint set with an ambit of murky diamonds, and warns, we can't let this high grade reach the wrong ears. Then Unc pauses for what's likely the sake of suspense. Pauses and says, you got to have tools, goddamn you mean. Meaning your rides, your crib, your clothes, your gold. You've got to. But all you got's a molehill without a mouthpiece. He points at his cracked lips, open with a sliver of space between them. A pipe smoker's lips, forever scorched. In those gorilla moves, he says, I swear for God, try them and see don't they get you nothing less of more of what you never wanted. That gorilla ain't about nothing, he says. A smart one comes from here, he says, and touches his temple. Never from here, he says. Unk assumes a southpaw stance, shakes miniature fists with abnormally big, unbruised knuckles, then switches to orthodox and whispers, "God damn you, me again, for God only knows." "Okay, now is as good a time as any to ask, good people, if you please, please preempt the hatrocity. He's my unk, all right? My real blood relative." "Say, nephew," Unk says, "this how you play it. Soon as you knock one, you keep your head down and palm up. Head down, palm up," he says again, assuming the pose. He stands a while after, a Buddhist maybe, lanky limbs hanging, lank neck sprouting out his weathered silk shirt, double creased slacks, secondhand gaiters spraddled, big knuckled babyish hands unfurled to show nails long enough to dredge coke, sharp enough to cut steak. To be true, Unk is sympathetic almost with what the years have done to him, with what he's done to himself over the years, though with the way he yearns, he might make more years than us all, be the only one alive the next coming, which is unsuspecting as shit, considering advice you'd call unholy or might couldn't. "Don't turn down nothing but your collar," he advises, which helped him become the first and penultimate around our way to hustle a plane. Though he now borrows hubcaps forever, hawks scrap metal for rent, and sends the mother of his youngest to a strip where the going rate is less than you drop on prime sirloin. Unk says, "I swear for God again, for who knows why." And people, you can say or think what you will, but my Unk might not be, matter of fact, most likely isn't, one of those old heads you can pay no never mind without it costing. "You're right," he says. "Hellified mouthpiece or not, just you try and knock one in a bucket. Just you try and knock one worth a damn without a couple of rides from the year of and at least one American-made manufactured when times was good." Unk tells me that his bottom leaving tripped a weak run. "But that's how it goes," he says. "One minute you're up and the next, well, you know." He pitches his formidable bug eyes at me. Eyes that can't anymore see past his past. He hops on a bench, plants a second-hand gaiter on the seat, and leaves the other hovering. He rubs his puny hands over a head of semi-receding stubble and says that normally the high grade is sold, not told, but since I'm family and all, he'll accept an IOU and a pack of menthols. He laughs and frisks the capacious pockets of his double-creased slacks, pockets once laden with down payment enough for anything, but now most often filled with less than, with atoms, straight Zeroth. "Position, not possession," he says, and warns, "never capitulate," in so many words. "My bad, I mean in so many words," the man says it.
So what does the gesture, head down, palms up, mean?
Well, as a pimp, your job is to get the most that you can from a woman. And so basically the gesture for them is to always give you something. So you go to them, you put your head down, you put your palm up, like, "What do you have for me now? What do you have for me now?"
And why is the head down? Is it you're not making eye contact or?
Yeah, well, I just started to consider this, that your head down is usually meaning that you are ashamed, right? So you're taking these things from a woman, both physically taking them as in her whatever she's made. And then you're also, you know, obviously stealing something that you can't replace and that, you know, is a lot more valuable than the money. And then if your head is down, you're ashamed of it. So it incorporates those two, that dissonance, that, yes, I'm doing something, but I'm not proud of this.
And there's also a sort of retreat
from
engaging mentally with that. And it's something that you go into, I think, really, really well also in the closing essay, Serial Killers, where you talk about what the serial killers is after is not really killing a body, but it's really about taking a soul.
Yeah. I think I came to that. I didn't, over my years of being a second-rate womanizer, I wasn't thinking that far into it. And I think one of the things I say in the essay is that you can't really afford to do too much introspection while you're doing this, or else you wouldn't be able to do it.
Right.
And so, you know, now that I'm retired, I feel, you know, I went and looked at that and I started thinking. The first time that I really had to engage with it was just kind of sit down and write it and say, well, why did I do those things? You know, so a lot of the a lot of the wisdom that is in Serial Killer is like, you know how they say you don't know what you're writing, but you can kind of write to an ending, or, you know, you can write to what you're supposed to be writing about. And I think that's a prime example, even though it's not fiction, in Serial Killer. Have you read you did tell me you read that Cheaters, the story by Junot Diaz.
I heard him read it.
Oh, okay.
At Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
So I haven't sat down to read it, but I do remember him actually himself reading it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was like, I wonder how it would feel for someone cold to read both of those things together. That would be, just, I want to see what someone would say about that.
Well, you know, I feel like the closer analogy might be After Everything.
Serial killer is
itself just and After Everything. Okay, if help the listeners out. After Everything describes what a woman says when she finds out that her man's been cheating.
Yeah.
That what you're going to do this after everything.
Yeah.
But Serial Killers, you know, one of the things that's so intriguing about the essay is you don't make the analogy neat.
Mm-hmm.
You don't say, oh, and by the way, there's a womanizer is like a serial killer in these ways. You just go, here's this thing about serial killers, and then you'll describe womanizers, and then you'll have occasionally a phrase that links the two,
mm-hmm.
but you're not really driving that metaphor home. And so I think it's a lot more interesting that way, that the reader has to sort of put these together a little bit and see how we feel about it. So while the point of the story is that there's this interrogation and judgment being made, it's a trial, basically, the narrator, who is you're putting yourself on trial, going, all right, are you judging me? You go ahead and judge me, but listen to the facts.
Mm-hmm.
But because you don't make that metaphor painfully explicit, well, I guess it's explicit, but you're not really explaining
mm-hmm.
why you're making this comparison, and you're letting us figure that out,
mm-hmm.
that the reader also winds up being a little bit more implicated. Like, well, if we're going to judge you, we also have to judge us.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that, and I know I'm going to talk about him, I talk about him a lot because he's probably he is the most influential person in my writing life, and that's Gordon Lish. And one of the things that he says is never explain. that's one of his fiction rules is like never explain. And so, well, you know, by definition, essay is exposition or explaining, but I didn't want it to be like I wanted to in some way explain, but I didn't want it to be like I was asking for sympathy. And so I kind of just wanted to say, okay, well, here is what has happened. Here might be some rationale for this. And then you take from that what you will. If you want to convict this person as a less than, then that, you know, that's on you. But I just wanted to be honest about it and kind of let people make their own decisions. I think I try to do the same thing in the fiction. It's kind of like, don't really explain it. You know, you get it. And if you, you know, if you don't get it, then maybe it wasn't for you. And kind of create those silences, you know, because I'm always looking for the silences in work, so that if I can create a silence, I think that that's, to me, when I'm reading and I sense that the author is telling me something by not telling me something, I feel enriched by figuring that out on my own.
Right. Well, it's Hemingway's iceberg principle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, and I could think of a couple of examples where. Yeah, and weak writers, they want to go, look at the whole iceberg down there. Do you see how huge the iceberg is? And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, we see it. Yeah.
We know what an iceberg is. And so just show us the tip of the iceberg, if you please. Yeah,
exactly.
And so you've been out of the program for a good long time.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you'd be willing to talk about just how you make ends meet and what your writing life has been like since leaving the program, since that's normally the bitch of it is when you leave.
Yeah.
You lose a whole lot of the support and a lot of the pressure to produce something.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to walk into the workshop going, sorry, I got
nothing. Yeah, right. I would say support-wise or how, you know, I was adjuncting because I had come out of the Portland State program to NYU. So I was adjuncting my whole way through the program just at other schools. And actually, I started working at NYU while I was in the program also. So, you know, as far as, you know, paying the rent and getting a hamburger, it's adjunct. And then also I do a fair bit of entertainment journalism, which I don't really like to mention that often because it doesn't feel like writing, but it does provide, it keeps me writing at least something, and it also, you know, provides a little bit of income. As far as writing, those people that I met, that I said I had a few readers, like we keep in contact, we share work, we're always, you know, hey, what are you working on? Kind of like that kind of workshop pressure where you, hey, what do you got this week? And I've even tried to start up a few workshops that lasted for a month or so. And
I've been there.
Yeah, you have? Oh, yeah, I think I might have contacted you one time. Like, hey, what do you think about a workshop on Tuesdays or something? So, you know, we always looking for that inspiration. And then, like I said, I took Gordon Lish 2 summers in a row, and that was like the greatest experience of a lifetime. I have all my notes from both of those years. It's like pages and pages and pages of notes, and I go back to them.
What was that experience like?
Oh, man.
I know that you said that he said, find out what makes you special.
Yeah.
But what was the experience like of being in that classroom?
It is the first time you're in it, it's really scary because he doesn't give the student or pupil any power. Like, it's clear from day one, like, I'm the head guy, I'm going to sit in here, I'm going to talk, and you're going to listen. And by the end of this, you're going to buy into everything I say because this is really the only way to do this. And so that's kind of his stance. But you realize when you're in the room that you're in a room with history. And, you know, you look at all the writers that he's worked with and you start listening to these stories and you're like, man, this guy, I haven't been around a person that is that brilliant. You know, like I can't imagine anyone being more brilliant than him. And I think also one of the things that gave me confidence even after I left the program was that he took a special interest in me.
Yep.
So he kind of singled me out from that first class. Is like, okay, I think this is one of the guys of promise. I bought his collection and he inscribed in it. This is not verbatim, but it says something like, this is for Mitchell Jackson, whose name the world will soon know. And he used to call me up at night and be like, Jackson, are you writing? Like, I think you can beat them all. You can be great. Just little stuff like that.
Shit.
So, you know, to have Gordon Lish calling you at midnight saying, I think you can be great. You start, you know, it's kind of like Customato and Mike Tyson. You start believing that stuff.
You better.
Yeah. I would say, you know, as far as my writing, the Lish and what came out of that, like my experience with the Center for Fiction, I became a fellow there. That all really came out of that experience with Lish. And then, you know, I teach, so that's how I'm eating.
And you teach a lot, right?
I teach a lot, yes. Yes, I
so
sure do.
How much is a lot,
I think
you could say?
The most that I've taught is 9 in a semester. I'm usually around 6, sometimes 7, but I don't know what I was doing that year I taught 9. But
And at
yeah.
How many schools?
3 schools... Is it 3? Might have been 4 the year I taught 9, but I think it's 3. Yeah, so it's NYU, Mega Everest College, John Jay College, and College of New Rochelle. Oh, no, that's 4, right? Yeah, NYU.
Before.
Yeah, that's 4. Yeah, yeah. And if you count the colleges in NYU, that makes it 5 because it's 2 different colleges. Yeah.
And that's...
I'm the super adjunct.
You are.
Yes.
You are. And, you know, it's... For listeners who don't know what adjunct work is, that means you're part-time.
Yeah.
And how many students do you usually have in a class?
Oh, my God. Well, it depends on the school. NYU, they're a little more charitable. They usually cap it at 16, and I usually get somewhere between 16 and 12, so that's manageable. At John Jay, I've had classes of up to 30, which gets a little unmanageable. You teach 2 or 3 classes of 30, and you got a lecture but you have to grade instead of in the lecture, you're just talking.
Yeah.
And then, let's see, in my other schools, yeah, somewhere around 15 to 20. So I guess if we do the math, what is that? So let's say roughly 20 students. So I probably have about 120 students, 130 students a semester.
Which they write things and then you have to read them.
Right.
And then you have to comment about
exactly.
them. And that's the...
Oh, my God.
That's where the problem is. It's not so much the numbers of people you have to say smart things to. It's that they have to write and you have to read it.
Yeah. I spend... After my first assignment, when the first assignment starts coming in, I will spend at least one night a week when in doing grading where I don't sleep at all. I mean, literally, like I come home, eat, start grading papers. By the time I finish, I might have to grade one on the train. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. I jump in the shower and I leave. I mean, that is without a doubt, I will do that at least once a week when papers start coming in. So it's and then try to write, you know. Try to write off of 0.08 hours of sleep. No good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's always curious. Yeah, I wind up being more experimental than I mean to be when I wind up writing under those circumstances. Seldom do I write anything coherent. And it's like, wow, that's sort of brilliant surrealism.
Yeah.
Let me
this
put that in the file.
This is a poem right here.
Well, I wrote one poem called Comments on the 57th Essay I've Read This Weekend.
That's
and hilarious. it's not really any particular, you know, the point is it's the 57th paper. Like for a student to write a bad paper, that's not a crime or anything.
Yeah.
It's when you have to read so many. And,
yeah.
But.
We love it. We love it.
Well, I've got a slightly sweeter gig. I'm a visiting instructor, which means I am guaranteed 4 classes and a semester. But the problem is that still means I have to teach 4 classes.
Yeah.
And,
how big are they?
Normally it's 24, I think.
Okay.
24. So it's about 100. And normally by the time we're 1 month in, that's about 90.
Oh, all right.
But I remember walking around with some colleagues back when I taught at Florida Atlantic University. And, you know, colleagues are complaining, oh, my God, they're making me teach 2 classes this term.
Yeah, right.
I can't handle it. And I'm like, you got to be fucking kidding me. And then they said, how many are you teaching? I'm like, 4. And I'm like, they're all writing classes? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, how much are you paid? And then I told them, and they're like, oh, you got to get out of here.
Yeah. It's something, boy.
Well, Mitchell, it was so great to talk to you. And I have to agree with Gordon Lish, man. Your name is going to be known by everybody.
Oh.
So.
Well, that's good. That's good. That's good. I hope so, man. You know, I just want to find some readers that genuinely, like, I hear writers talk about fans, and that just seems so I don't know what the word is, but I just want people.
Unliterary.
I just want to give a note to my fan. I just want people to appreciate my work. I don't need a fan. I just need someone who says, I really like that guy's work. That's it.
Well, I think the idea of fanatics is a little bit too entertaining or something. Like, this gives me a superficial sense of belonging where literature, I think, opens up ourselves more as people.
Yeah.
Where wearing a Star Trek outfit doesn't necessarily – not that there's anything wrong with that, but
right,
wearing a Star Trek outfit doesn't really expand your consciousness necessarily.
Right, yeah. That's what it is. Expand my – that's
and
it.
So if you're a fan of a writer, I love Hunter S. Thompson. I don't know that I love his fans. Like a lot of people like his work, but you got to – got to pour a little cold water on that shit.
Yeah.
Or else, you know, you have all these wannabes. So I wish you all the best and definitely keep us appraised out here at the Drunken Odyssey of any new publications and any news you got, all right?
Okay, will do.
Great to talk to you, man.
All right.
And now, a book discussion. A book that changed my life.
Into a Memory by Robert Kingett. When I was little, I did not wander as a cloud. I floated on one. I have to admit, when the assignment was given to me, a 22-year-old college student, to write about a poem, I did not think I would find one that would capture my interest or my memory. For days, my ears would burn the table of contents as my fingers struck down page numbers in a hopeless search to find something that I could connect with, or something that I could write about and have it be genuine. I was lost, and my hopes for finding a poem that would even hold my interest long enough to allow me to write about it seemed to be an impossible reach. I was a bibliophile at heart, but I did not like writing about poetry. I enjoyed reading it, but writing about it was a different kind of circle of hell. On my fifth haphazard hunt through the table of contents, my ears caught something that I had not noticed. I was instantly drawn because it sounded familiar. I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud by William Wordsworth. I wanted to see why the poem sounded familiar. I had an odd sense that it would be significant to my life, but I did not know why it would be or even how. I wanted to explore the kind of emotional journey that this poem would take me through, and so I did. After listening to the first line, I was instantly transported to a memory that I did not even know I had. It is late at night. I am six. I remember feeling the Braille calendar poised in my lap, my finger tracing the soft indentations of the moons among the days. A sound erupts from the living room and I look up, my ears picking up every shift of the air just a few rooms from me. Shouting soon breaks out, as if I am in a pep rally. The shouting grows louder and more obscene with each passing word. My mother has made her appearance on stage yet again, and I start to sob. I'm guessing that Grandma and Grandpa are out in the fray as well, but I do not want to be in here all alone. The shouting reaches a volume that I do not even know exists, and my fright and anger mesh into one emotion as the stupidity of the situation finally reaches me. As my mother and her husband continue to scream at each other while mixing in some sounds of hitting and smacking, and manage to produce sounds of someone hitting the table, Grandma comes into the room. I know it is she because I can smell the peach-scented perfume that I always smell when she is within a few feet from me. It is as if the smell alone is a blanket about to wrap me up. My bedroom door softly clicks shut, and tender shoes thud over to me. She takes my small hand in hers. "Are you ready for bed?" she asks me. I smile and nod, while all the while trying to hide my anger at my stupid mother. "Well, I'm sorry. I do not have a story for you tonight. All I have is this book of poems your grandfather gave to me." A groan at the mention of poetry, even at that young age. I much rather prefer it when she read me something good, such as Nancy Drew or the Hardy Boys. I do not want to stay here any longer. Moreover, I like it when Grandma reads to me. Outside of my bubble of safety, my mother starts to cry as Grandpa yells at her about how stupid she is acting. I hear pages slowly open. Grandma leans to read, and instantly I am taken to the place of golden daffodils, leaving the screaming behind me. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high over vales and hills. When all at once I saw a crowd, a host, of golden daffodils. I am soon floating on the cloud looking at dancing yellow flowers. As Grandma continues to read the poem to me, I feel a sense of peace. I am flying. And the newly developed sounds of clashing in the kitchen are just a faint whisper. I am swept away by Grandma's reading. We both are wandering as a cloud, but not lonely. I listen with eagerness as she finishes the poem, allowing me to ignore the stupid smashing sounds in the next room. Once she is all done, she tucks me in and kisses me goodnight. She tells me she loves me and then leaves the room. I soon drift on my own cloud of safety, finally able to feel calm and happy enough to go to sleep. I am comfortable and soon floating on my own cloud that is floating across vales and hills, far from the treachery of the world. I am safe. That was when I was six. That memory of Grandma sprang to mind when I first listened to the poem. I reread the poem after that, repeatedly, making it my comfort poem. While I was reading the poem at that young age, I had a literal visual interpretation of the poem. It seemed pretty logical and obvious to me that that was what the poem meant, that the speaker was looking down at golden flowers swaying in the wind. I believed it so strongly that I vividly imagined this. Back then, I pictured vibrantly the golden tendrils swaying gently in the breeze, and some shadow sitting up high on a pink cloud, looking down at this dancing show. For a long time, that is how I interpreted the poem. I do not know where my interpretation changed, but it did. I presume that it changed just after my grandmother died, and I had no way of escaping the domestic violence I had to endure. I would always wish that Grandma would come softly into my room, click my door shut, and take me with her on a cloud high above the bad things in my life. With the passing of years, I never saw or heard the poem again. Now, when I heard the poem again, I was instantly six again, feeling a sense of love. I replayed the poem, wearing out the skip back button on my CD player in order to keep hold of the memory that this poem helped to bring back from the dead. I love this rare opportunity to smell Grandma's peach-scented perfume again. I love the chance to hear her powerful, delicately articulate voice read me a poem to take away all the bad things in my life. Listening to the poem now, I soon realized that I had a different interpretation. Perhaps this interpretation came from her death when I was seven. I believe that the loss of my grandmother, physically and mentally, has helped me to make this interpretation once I reclaimed her in my memory after so long of an absence. This poem helped me regain a memory that I did not even know existed within me. The speaker talks about how he is happy to watch golden daffodils dance. My grandmother was always like that, happy to see, create, and experience pure happiness. This poem, I believe, is what my grandmother sees and saw. Because of this realization about my grandmother, I no longer have the same image when I listen to the poem. I picture someone looking down on people, but not just any people. I picture someone looking down at me and a few other people, some wealthy, some poor, some old, some young, some black, some white, some Asian, and some of everything. All of us are dancing with an airy display for our spectator. We all twirl and giggle as we all choreograph a perfect rhythm. I no longer picture the shadow on top of the cloud as having no face or figure. It now has a form and a shape to it. It is someone I know. I picture the wrinkly old woman looking down at us, softly smiling. She is comfortable on the pink cloud, basking in her glory and her peace. I am sure if we were closer, we would smell the peach-scented perfume. I picture the old woman slowly bringing her wrinkled hands together, clapping and shedding silent tears as she watches the spectacle. I would like to think that she would be smiling at this point, glad to finally have the opportunity to watch the best show in the world, the show of a host of golden daffodils tossing our heads up in a sprightly dance. Into a Memory by Robert Kingette was read by Joseph Longini.
Robert Kingette is a freelance writer and editor in Florida. Robert created, edited, and produced The Cobra, the first ever newspaper, at the Florida School for the Deaf and the Blind, his freshman year in high school. His work appeared in Teens Inc. Monthly magazine, Fred's Head, a blog on adaptive technology, and many more. He's currently obtaining a BA in journalism.
And now, the Drunken Odyssey mailbag.
My pal Ryan Rivas has written in to ask Do I favor reading anything in particular outside of the genre of what you're working on, say reading poetry while writing fiction, in order to be inspired or influenced? If so, why do you think that is? Well, one of the upsides of reading outside of the genre that you're working in is that you do get to stimulate your mind as a reader, and whatever influence that may provide just seems so abstract that it's not really a threat, that there's no anxiety of influence that's likely to occur while you're working on a piece of fiction if you're reading poetry or vice versa. If I were reading lots of Sylvia Plath, Tony Hoagland, James Tate, Billy Collins, whoever, that might lead me to... Now, if you read all of those, okay, that's an interesting mix and it's likely to even out. But really, there could be the tendency to start making moves like those poets. And there's a really interesting corollary to this, because when you're reading one of those monolithic books that are out there, one of those monolithic novels, one of those novels that are really designed to change your life, you know, Ulysses, Gravity's Rainbow, Infinite Jest. And to that list, we should also add Proust's novel series, Remembrance of Things Past. These books get inside your head, and like philosophy, you really have to reprogram your brain just to read them. And it took me about a year to stop writing like Joyce, maybe longer than that, when I read Ulysses for the first time. And so there's a real danger that the influence actually does become too strong when you have too strong an influence in your mind. I guess that's sort of self-evident. And so when you're reading one of these long-term projects that you simply can't, you know, no matter how big a Harry Potter novel was, normally I would finish it in a weekend. Whereas the Proust novel cycle took me, all seven novels took me a year. A year of slow, dense reading that I really, really enjoyed. And, you know, my friend Kevin Crawford asked me, he said, you know, I should read Proust. I keep hearing about it. You know, he's one of those, legendary writers that you're supposed to have read. He's kind of the hallmark of a cultivated, civilized life. I really need to read him. What is he like, John? I told him, he's like Henry James, but more so. And Kevin shivered in absolute abject horror. But these books really do have a tendency to just take over your mind. Live in there, you know, they get their ass imprints on the sofa of your thoughts, and it's really difficult to hide those influences sometimes. You know, once you're in the habit of reading Proust, try writing a short sentence followed by a short sentence. It's nearly impossible. And so while I love reading such books, on the other hand, I don't know that I go back and reread them. I simply can't afford it necessarily. Ulysses, of course, it's like a blue tip match. You could strike it anywhere, so I read passages from time to time, but seldom do I sit down with a whole book and just say, oh, this is what I'm going to do with this month. I'm going to read Ulysses. But I do love the cross-pollination of reading things that are different than what I'm working on, just to sort of keep my mind honest. This seems like a long, rambling answer to a fairly basic question, but that's normally what I do here in the mailbag section, isn't it? What's that, Lauren?
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Well, I have run out of show for yet another week. Thank you, dear listeners, for downloading, streaming, or doing whatever it is that you've done to get a hold of me and put me in your head. If you like the show, please tell anyone you know who might also like the show. Spread the word. And keep your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.